This is FM 90.1 KCFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And you're listening to Ecotopia, a weekly program exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. I'm Susan Chudy.
And I'm Stephen Chudy. Tonight's program is one for the birds. We'll be talking with author Cy Montgomery about her new book, Birdology, which is a celebration of the amazing physical and mental characteristics of birds, along with stories of her experiences working with them and with some of the people who love and train them. And tonight with us again is Jeff Inslee in our studio.
This program is made possible in part by member contributions and by Cartridge World in Chico, specializing in printer cartridge refilling and remanufacturing for a green community. Cartridge World uses recycled cartridges for most home and business printers, copiers, and faxes. Cartridge World in Chico is located inside the Safeway Plaza next to Tri-County's Bank. More information is available by calling 342-3333. The opinions voiced on this program do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers.
We'll have some background on what Cy Montgomery calls birdology right after this.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life, you were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see. All your life, you are only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird, fly. Blackbird, fly. Into the line of a dark black night. Black night. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life, you are only waiting for this moment to arise. You are only waiting for this moment to arise. You are only waiting for this moment to arise.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and tonight we'll be talking about birds, their nature, their intelligence, their evolutionary history.
EarthLife.net tells us that there are about 9,703 species of birds. They can be found on all major landmasses from the poles to the tropics, as well as in or over all our seas and oceans and their accompanying islands.
The total number of birds on the planet is very difficult to estimate because of their populations and their fluctuation, but scientists have suggested that there may be between 100 and 200 trillion adult birds on the planet at any given time.
Since the 1600s, however, at least 115 species of birds are known to have gone extinct, mostly as a result of human interference of one sort or another.
We were actually surprised by that extinction number. It seemed relatively small to us, given what we humans have done to the planet. Listeners may also recall that we had an interview several months ago with Alvin Powell about the unsuccessful efforts to save the Pōʻuli in Hawaii from extinction. You can find that program archived on our website, ecotopiakzfr.net, as program number 54. And included in that program was a good deal of information on the Endangered Species Act and efforts to protect birds and other critters from extinction.
One of the best-known extinction stories, of course, is that of the dodo, and this one is described by David Riley. In the year 1598 A.D., Portuguese sailors landing on the shores of the island of Mauritius in the southwest Indian Ocean off Africa discovered a previously unknown species of bird, which came to be called the dodo. Having been isolated by its island location from contact with humanity, the dodo greeted the new visitors with childlike innocence. The sailors mistook the gentle spirit of the dodo and its lack of fear of the new predators as stupidity. They dubbed the bird dodo, meaning something similar to a simpleton in Portuguese language. Many dodo were killed by the human visitors, and those that survived, man had to face the introduced animals. Dogs and pigs soon became feral when introduced to the Mauritian ecosystem. By the year 1681, the last dodo had died.
There are, however, a few positive news stories about extinction. Earthlife.net notes the example of the Mauritius kestrel from the same island as the dodo. Once was down to 4 wild individuals, but now there are more than 300. And there's the great success story of the California condor, which, after the last wild male was caught in 1987, was down to 27 individuals, all in captivity. By 1994, captive breeding had brought the population up to 75, with 9 in the wild.
Our guest tonight is an unabashed bird lover and one who celebrates birds of all kinds, from the barnyard chicken to some pretty aggressive raptors. We'll be back to talk with Cy Montgomery right after this.
Believe it or not, we are found.
given, offer up to the next downstream. Row, row, row your boat gently down. May the circle be unbroken. Merry go round again.
Red Bird, sung by Ma Muse from their Strange and Wonderful album. Our guest tonight on Ecotopia is Cy Montgomery. She's author of a new book from Simon & Schuster. It's titled Birdology. Cy is a naturalist. She's traveled all over the world observing birds and animals, then writing about them. In this book, she shares, as the subtitle tells us, lessons learned from a pack of hens, a peck of pigeons, cantankerous crows, fierce falcons, hip-hop parrots, baby hummingbirds, and one murderously big cassowary. Welcome to the show, Cy Montgomery.
I'm thrilled to be on.
Thanks very much. Did you put the chickens to roost before we started the program?
Oh, you bet. I'm out in New Hampshire. It's dark here, and it's time for them to be in.
Great. You begin the book by identifying yourself as a birdologist as opposed to an ornithologist. Please tell us about that distinction.
Well, an ornithologist, as you probably know, is somebody who's a scientist and has a PhD usually. A birdologist is actually a term that I did not coin. It was coined by a wonderful minister at a church I usually don't go to, the First Universalist Church in West Chesterfield, New Hampshire. But when I saw the title of the sermon that they were going to be having, I just couldn't resist because the title was Birdology. And she made the word up. And she said that a birdologist is somebody who experiences the divinity of creation revealed in the birds.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
So she said, you know, we should all be birdologists. She said that watching birds, this is her quote, strengthens our souls.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And so this is what I've always felt when I see a bird, any bird. You know, I feel that my heart can really soar with them. I've always been drawn to birds, and this book is kind of my effort to figure out what makes a bird, and to reawaken both our sense of awe in their presence and our sense of kinship with them, even though they're very, very different from us.
So it sounds like you've been working on this book, at least in your head, for quite a while.
Yeah, actually, I guess... my first real love in life, certainly the first male ever to court me, was in fact a bird. He was a parakeet, and I was 7, and he threw up on my finger.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes. His name was Jerry, and I brought him home from a dime store, you know, back when you could, when there were dime stores.
Right.
And I recognized, even at that tender age, even though I'd been thrown up upon before, that when a bird does this, it's a tender, loving thing, and it's what you do to your mate and to your babies. And it's his way of saying, you are special to me, so special I want to even give you some food. And I was crazy in love with this little guy, and we lived together for quite some time. He was just a wonderful creature. And I think ever since I've been 7, I've been thinking about birds and how different they are from us, and the miracle that creatures so different from us, we can still have such a meaningful relationship with somebody like that.
And one of the sort of ideas that goes through your book is that they are underappreciated by the average person, that birds are not fully recognized for all of their great qualities.
Well, I think that's true, because if you ask a typical person, did you see any wild animals today? You know, unless you live out in the country or in the forest, most people think they haven't. But, of course, every pigeon you see, every sparrow, all of us see wild animals every day, and they are the birds, and yet we kind of discount them because they are so common. But the miracle of it is that we are surrounded, no matter where we live, with wildness and wonder, and the birds bring us this.
And you even appreciate chickens.
Oh, yes, indeed. I sure do. They're part of my family.
So you think that chickens are smarter than most people seem to think, and that they have personalities.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think part of the problem is that most of us, alas, our relationship with chickens is of a culinary nature. And no one is at their best when they are dead and cooked and sitting on someone's dinner plate.
Yeah.
So at least I wouldn't be. And my ladies, for more than 20 years, I've had a flock of chickens. And that doesn't mean that any one of my chickens is 21 years old. It's like a flock culture that keeps going on. And they definitely have very individual personalities. They definitely have strong emotions. They definitely recognize individuals, not just each other, but us too. For example, my flock is absolutely crazy about the neighbors next door, Jarvis and Bobby Coffin. Loves those people. The folks across the street, not so much. But they love Bobby and Jarvis so much that when they hear their back porch door slam, they'll run over and they'll mob them like Bobby and Jarvis are some kind of rock star. They'll sometimes climb two flights of stairs to get up to their porch so they can look in and try to induce Bobby and Jarvis to come out and play with them. And there's data, actually, from the scientists that study this kind of thing that shows that the average chicken recognizes at least 100 other individuals. And they recognize these individuals, whether they are human or whether they are fellow birds, by looking into their faces, the same way we recognize each other. And you know how they found this out? I mean, this is so interesting to me. Scientists are always playing these terrible pranks, it seems, on the animals that they study. And what they did was they took chickens in a flock, and they would, like, dye their feathers funny and then see if they still recognized the chicken with the dyed feathers. So they'd even pull some of their feathers out, or they'd put silly outfits on them or put fake feet on them. No problem until you start messing with the chicken's face. And the minute you put, like, a fake comb on, or you remove feathers from the face, or you give them big googly eyes or something, that's when the chickens don't recognize each other. It's just like us. We're the same. We look into people's faces, and we look into the faces of other beings. It's almost like the soul resides in the face.
In one of your chapters, too, you say that we've been misled about dinosaurs. First of all, they taught us in school that there was a thing called the Brontosaurus. Then they pranked us by changing the name. And then they told us that the dinosaurs were extinct. You say the dinosaurs didn't go extinct. They became
birds. And I'm thrilled. I cried inconsolably when I found out dinosaurs were extinct. I did not care there was no Tooth Fairy and Santa Claus of fiction, not a problem. But when I found out my friends the dinosaurs were extinct, it was terrible. And I'm so happy to learn that scientists now say that they didn't go extinct. They turned into one of the most successful groups of creatures on the planet today, the class Aves, the birds. And that makes me feel much better.
Could you link that for us maybe to, you've done a lot with hummingbirds. How is a hummingbird like a dinosaur?
Yeah, boy, it sure doesn't seem like it, does it?
No.
But actually, little tiny hummingbirds, sparrows, any bird that you mention, is a direct descendant of the largest and most predatory carnivorous creatures that ever lived. They are Tyrannosaurus rex, a descendant of Tyrannosaurus rex. And you can see some of these adaptations still in the birds, because all the things that let birds fly, these are all... my dog is having a fit here. I know that your readers... your listeners aren't gonna mind. Sometimes she just doesn't like the arrangement of the house and needs to dig in a box or scratch in the rug or something like that. Maybe we'll hear from her later.
We're border collie people also, so we appreciate her.
Oh, have you got a border collie?
We got two, plus a 50-50 Akita border collie mix.
Wow, you must be the most efficient people in the world. I hope you have those dogs making your stock trades for you, because they are such geniuses, aren't
they?
They're
so smart, yeah.
Well, I bet they keep you on deadline.
Yeah.
Wow. Sorry, but I interrupted you there.
Oh, well, that was all right. I know, mammals just keep intruding all the time, I find. Well, birds and dinosaurs, many of the things that made predatory dinosaurs good at what they did also pre-adapted the birds to flight. They have swiveling wrists. They had grasping hands. They had long tails. They had big eyes and large brains. And all of these were things that you need to fly. Now, the first predatory dinosaurs, of course, didn't fly at all, but many of them had feathers. And it's now quite surprising to learn that Tyrannosaurus Rex, when he hatched out of his egg, was covered in down. There were loads of dinosaurs who were covered with feathers. And we don't know what those feathers were for. There's interesting theories about this, but no one knows what they're for. But, you know, evolution kind of works with what's at hand. And since there are already feathers on these guys, it worked out to be awfully handy when you were going to fly. And another thing that happened to the dinosaurs as they turned into birds is they became much lighter. They lost their teeth, and the reason, your head, your skull becomes less heavy when you don't need teeth. This is why birds often have to pick up grit and stones to grind their food, because they don't have teeth. It's scarce as hen's teeth. It's to make them light. And hummingbirds exemplify the fact that birds are really made of air. And this shows us the amazing transformation that the predatory dinosaurs underwent more than any other bird. You know, the hummingbird really shows this. They're the lightest birds in the sky. And per body length, they're also the fastest birds in the world, faster even than the peregrine falcon. The peregrine falcon actually, you know, it can dive at 200 miles an hour. Wow. But if you're going to look at body length and, you know, your speed relative to body length per second, there's one species of hummingbird, the Allen's hummingbird, which is actually faster than the space shuttle as it screams down through the atmosphere. Because a space shuttle comes down at, 200-plus body lengths per second. And the Allen's hummingbird descends at more than 300 body lengths per second.
Wow.
So the hummingbirds are great. They're just super birds. And I could not wait to get to know some better. And for this book, I got to have all these great adventures with seven birds, each of whom exemplified a different aspect of essential birdiness. And what I got to do for my hummingbird chapter to show us that birds are made of air is I worked with a hummingbird rehabilitator who rehabilitates and releases orphaned baby hummingbirds.
Oh, my gosh.
And they are born, these things are born from eggs the size of navy beans. They hatch out the size of bumblebees. They seem like just bubbles wrapped in feathers. They're not even wrapped in feathers when they're born. They're naked and they have these stubby little bills and they're all pink. And they transform into these incredible beings, capable of feats that would, you know, Superman would be happy if he could do any of these things.
And you've also described the incredible commitment it takes to rescue a hummingbird. It's an around-the-clock affair. Could you talk a little bit about that, please?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Well, I had the great pleasure to work with Brenda Sherburn, who has been rehabilitating these birds for quite some time and has an excellent record. This year, by the way, she had more than 50 baby hummingbirds come to her. Most of whom survived, and she let go, and they're flying free. Every 20 minutes, what you have to do is feed them 200 crushed fruit flies, gushed up with a mortar and pestle, mixed with a special formulation of oils and enzymes and nectars, and delivered to their tiny gaping mouths with a syringe. Which scares you to death. If you miss a feeding, they can starve. But worse, if you give them too much, they can pop. Because they are little bubbles. They are little bubbles made of air. And this is what gives them their extraordinary powers to conquer the sky. The fact that they are made of air. And like all birds, their bones are hollow. Their skeleton weighs less than their feathers.
Wow.
Their heads, their skulls are scaffolded for maximum lightness. And they're just all lung. They're filled with air sacs. If you look inside a baby hummingbird, it's mostly air in there.
Yeah.
They've got 9 air sacs in that little tiny body.
Yeah.
Some birds have even more. But, oh my gosh, Brenda's commitment and that of her consort, Russ LaBelle, it was so moving to work with them and to see that, you know, there really is nothing more important in your day than feeding a hungry baby hummingbird.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your life, you know, at first you think, oh gosh, my life has stopped. Brenda is a very talented artist and sculptor. And of course, she doesn't do a whole lot of art or sculpting while every 20 minutes she has to mix up this new batch of food and feed it to these little birds. But she really showed me how your life doesn't stop for these birds. Your life kind of begins again. That the Spanish called hummingbirds resurrection birds because they were believed to be so beautiful and shiny that surely something that gorgeous had to be made anew each day.
Mm.
And to me, working with them, it was like having a hand in resurrection. It was such an incredible blessing. And to see them grow from these helpless little creatures to these astonishingly powerful flyers who can fly upside down and backwards and beat their wings so fast that we couldn't even see or count their wing beats until the invention of a machine called the stroboscope.
Mm, interesting. Mm-hmm. You also have explored animal and bird intelligence, and Snowball is a good example of bird intelligence and bird language, parrot language. Can you tell us a little bit about Snowball?
Oh, boy. Well, have you seen the video of Snowball, by the way, on YouTube?
Yes, mm-hmm. We looked it up.
I bet that many of your listeners have, too, because this was a video that went viral like the second it was posted. Snowball is a sulfur-crested cockatoo, medium-sized,
mm-hmm.
who came to a parrot rescue center called Bird Lovers Only with his own CD. And the guy who gave the bird up said, just play it. Just watch what happens. And Irina Schultz, the person who runs Bird Lovers Only, turns on the CD, plays the CD, and could not believe what happened. This cockatoo totally rocks out to certain songs. And he will erect his crest. He will march on his feet. He'll turn from side to side. He will do all kinds of special things with his wings. He's got at least 9 different dance moves that I know of, and he's adding more all the time. And the most amazing thing, and the thing that has attracted the interest of scientists, is that not just that he dances, but that he dances to the beat. And
yeah.
This shows a cognitive ability known as beat perception and synchronization. And it's something closely associated with linguistic ability in humans.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this is what fascinated people. I mean, anybody who watches this, I really, if anyone's having a bad day out there, just put in
Snowball
Dancing Cockatoo.
Yeah.
Your day's going to get much better really fast. It's a riot. But it gives us a really interesting look into the minds of these creatures who really are dinosaurs. They're much more closely related to dinosaurs than we are.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, they enjoy many of the same things that we consider marks of higher culture. After all, parrots talk.
Mm-hmm.
Parrots dance. Parrots enjoy music. These are all things that we think are hallmarks of higher learning and cognition. And yet, these creatures with brains, you know, a parrot's got a pretty big skull compared to most birds, and his brain's the size of a walnut. But they enjoy all of these things. It's so interesting. It's such an interesting lens into their lives. And Snowball doesn't actually say all that much, although he does speak meaningfully from time to time. But there's another parrot in that chapter, too, that I'm sure you've heard of, Alex. The African
mm-hmm.
gray. And Irene Pepperberg here in New England, she's at Brandeis and at Harvard, both here right now, and I'm delighted that we're good friends now. She's done the most amazing studies proving that Alex understands exactly what he's saying and understands concepts, understands symbols. He can add. He makes up words. He uses language in a very human-like way. And he even does stuff that kids do when they're learning language. She put this is one of my favorite, God, there's so many wonderful anecdotes about Alex, but one of them was that she hid a voice-activated tape recorder in the lab so that she could find out what he was doing after she left. And after he'd been having lessons and she would leave, he would practice, just like a kid practices. And he would play with sounds. And what he loved was to create new sounds that rhymed, just like kids do. So to me, that says birds love poetry. Birds love poetry, birds love dance, birds love language. And so do we.
Wow, fascinating stories. We want to hear more of these stories. We are talking with Cy Montgomery. She is the author of Birdology, and the subtitle is fabulous. Lessons learned from a pack of hens, a pack of pigeons, cantankerous crows, fierce falcons, hip-hop parrots, baby hummingbirds, and one murderously big cassowary. And we want to hear about the cassowary. Excuse me. Wow, I'm worse than your dog. But we'll take a short break here and come back and hear some more bird stories.
Four and 20 blackbirds perched on the mill house floor. Four and 20 blackbirds perched on the mill house floor. Watching a pair of blackbirds, a pair of blackbirds more. Four and 20 blackbirds perched on the mill house floor. So one blackbird to the other, you must be my queen. So one blackbird to the other says, you must be my queen. The other replied in turn, well, show enough, you're my king. Four and 20 blackbirds and two began to sing. Now the queen she sang of a mill house rising to the sky. The king he sang of riches baked in a honey pie. Stick your finger in and taste it on the sly. Sing a song of sixpence and a pocket full of rye. Now the queen, she asked that question, what makes a mill house rare? The king replied in turn,
that's
well,
Voices on the Verge, so performing Blackbirds from their Live in Philadelphia album. This is Ecotopia. We're back on the phone with author Cy Montgomery, author of a new book called Birdology. I wonder, Cy, we've got lots of stories that we'd love to hear from you, but particularly about the cassowary, a bird that most of us don't know much about, and you hunted, not hunted.
I looked for
the cassowaries. Please tell us a little bit about your experience with the cassowary.
Oh, man. I have known about cassowaries for a very long time, and I'm fascinated with flightless birds. But the reason that I sought to meet a wild cassowary is that the cassowary actually looks more like a dinosaur than some dinosaurs did. Mm-hmm. The bird is 150 pounds. It's as tall as a person. And on its head, it has this huge, tall helmet of bone, which reminds me so much of the hadrosaurs, or duck-billed dinosaurs. Mm-hmm. It also has, and it's renowned for this, has a slashing toenail on its huge, powerful feet, with which it occasionally eviscerates people, earning it the title of the most dangerous bird in the world. But I was not the least bit afraid of meeting a cassowary. I was desperately afraid I wouldn't meet a cassowary, because then what was I going to do about chapter two? I needed to see this cassowary because that chapter is called Birds Are Dinosaurs, and I desperately wanted to meet one face to face. It was quite an ordeal getting to do so, and I was afraid up to my very last day that I wouldn't get to meet one. But I did.
So how did you meet him or her?
Well, what meeting one entailed a lot of luck. You had to be in the right place, and of course the cassowary some people may be glad to learn that it only lives in Queensland, Australia, and the island of New Guinea. Both places I visited, but on in Queensland, there's a place called Mission Beach, which is known as the cassowary capital of the world. Well, the first day I went out looking for a cassowary, I actually hadn't gone to Mission Beach yet. I was in a place, the Atherton Tablelands, and I had gone with a researcher into his area and came out, and I was waiting for my friends to pick me up. When they drove up to the parking lot and found me standing there, they looked at me with stricken horror on their faces. I looked down and saw why. I was covered in blood. I looked like I'd been shot. And the reason was I had been attacked by dozens and dozens of leeches. And I had never seen so much of my own blood before. What gruesome. Oh, my gosh. And then as I sat in their car waiting to go back to their house, I saw these bloated leeches falling out of my pants and shirt to the floor. And it was just really gross. Uh-huh. But, you know, the next day, back I went again. I could not wait. There was nothing I wouldn't do to see a cassowary. Well, I ended up moving to a place that had fewer leeches. Day after day, I would just walk around hoping to meet a cassowary. And I spent day after day doing this. Well, the night before I was going to leave, I did not see a cassowary, but I knew I was very near one because I felt at first rather than heard the voice of this bird. And it is exactly like the sound. If you've ever seen Jurassic Park, you know the part before you see the dinosaurs, that dinosaurs are coming, but you hear them before you see them. It's this amazing sound that seems to arise from your chest. It's like an earthquake. And it has infrasonic components like an earthquake. That's the sound this bird makes. So dinosaur-like, so ancient, so stirring, so thrilling. And I knew as I waited towards dusk in the dark rainforest that somewhere near me was this 150-pound bird that I had waited so long and come so far to see. But I still didn't see him.
Oh.
Well, it wasn't until the next day. And in fact, if everything had been on time, including the little bus that was to take me to Cairns to fly back to America, if that bus had been on time, I never would have seen the cassowary. But because that bus was late, I took one last hike up a place called Bicton Hill, where I'd heard the cassowary the night before. And I'd totally given up. At that point, I just kind of went to offer my presence like a prayer to the cassowary gods or something. And as I was sitting on a bench, just before it was getting dark, practically hearing myself sweat, then all of a sudden it stepped out from the forest like a crack through time. And there in front of me, not 10 feet away, was this incredible bird, taller than I was. Just walking out so close that I could see the eyelashes around the orange eye, and I could see the red wattles just swaying back and forth as it walked against the blue neck, and I could see the gleaming, slashing toenail. I could see when the cassowary picked up fruit. I could see it swallow the fruit. I could watch the fruit go all the way down the blue neck, and yet the bird, even though I'm sure it could see me, never looked at me. And it really felt like I had gone back in time, back to a time that there weren't any humans. So of course it wouldn't have seen me. It was just like time travel.
We're talking with author Cy Montgomery about her book Birdology. It's published by Simon and Schuster. Cy, your book is mostly narrative, and listening to you tonight, we understand why. You're such a terrific storyteller. And there are many, many more stories in the book that our listeners might enjoy, would enjoy.
Will enjoy.
But we were struck by a compact paragraph. It's right at the close of the book where you say, in essence, the bird population is in trouble, and you talk about some of the suspects for causing that problem. I wonder if we could shift gears a little bit and talk about your environmental or ecological concerns for the future of the bird population.
Yeah, thank you. I really do want to talk about that. Well, as many of your listeners probably know, BirdLife International, not long ago, recently came out with an alarming report that one quarter of all American bird species have declined just since 1970.
Yeah.
And this is horrible.
Yeah.
In just like four decades, some of our most beloved common birds, including the bobwhite, you know, bobwhite, it has suffered a population loss of 82%.
Mm-hmm.
And in both North and South America, where all the hummingbirds in the world live, they only live in North and South America, 28 species of hummingbirds are threatened with extinction, not just decline, but extinction.
Mm-hmm.
And the scene is even worse in Europe, where 45% of common birds are in decline. The turtle dove has lost 62% of its population in 25 years. It just keeps going and going. The nightingale is disappearing. In Africa, more bad news. I mean, some of the greatest birds, the enormous eagle species that live there, they've declined by up to 98% in some countries. It's horrible. I mean, parrots worldwide, nearly a third of them are threatened with extinction. It's horrible. And how can we let this happen? At one point, you know, people who used to conjecture about what's heaven like and what's hell like, hell was defined in part as a place with no birds. And if we let this continue, we will have succeeded in turning this great green breathing planet into hell. And we know why it's happening. And we know how to stop it. All we need is the will to do what we already know what to do. We know it, the same reason that everything else is going bad is the reason that the birds are declining. It's, you know, the usual suspect. Global warming, according to the IUCN, or global climate change, is the number one reason. And all of these other things that feed into it, human overpopulation, industrial-scale factory farming, rapacious and wasteful logging, humans bringing foreign species to places they don't belong. We know all of these things cause species extinction everywhere. We know it's no good for us, even. But we're doing it, and what we have to do is stop it. So let's see if we can get it together.
Do you think, could it be that the birds are stuck? Are they dependent? Will people do this out of respect for bird populations, or is it just that humans themselves might be driven to the edge of extinction and then say, oh, yeah, we'll take care of ourselves, and then the birds benefit almost as a byproduct?
Well, what's interesting is that, on the one hand, recovery efforts for certain birds have been tremendously successful and had enormous public support. One example, actually, I write about this in a children's book that just came out that I wrote called Kakapo Rescue. I went to New Zealand to assist with recovery efforts for the largest and strangest parrot in the world, this enormously heavy, nocturnal, flightless parrot named the Kakapo. And you would not believe, people wait for years to volunteer to assist bringing these birds back. And to do it, you have to fly to this remote island, and it's in the roaring 40s. The weather is terrible. Most of the time, the people have no hope of even seeing a kakapo, and yet they will do this. People do love birds, and they will go to great efforts on their behalf. It's just... And, you know, hummingbirds, another example. People will go to great efforts to save a little hummingbird, even just ordinary people. You don't have to be a Mother Teresa or a Brenda Sherburn to want to save a little hummingbird. But will we change our buying habits? Will we turn down the thermostat? Will we vote in a way that will protect the birds? It's my hope that we will. And I look to birds like the hummingbird to show us miracles and to give us the courage that we need to protect this planet. Birds have inspired us forever, and they've acted as canaries in the coal mine, as you had written to me earlier. And with inspiration like that, I think, yeah, we can do this. We can turn this thing around.
You mentioned the Kakapo Rescue. This is your children's book, and you are so passionate about birds. Is your next project a bird-related project, or what is your next project?
Well, actually, this is wild. I'm doing a kid's biography of a human.
Oh,
but it's an animal-related human. And it's a person, I'm sure you'll recognize her name, Temple Grandin. Temple Grandin is an autistic woman who, incredibly, is a college professor, and she's an industrial designer. And what she does for a living grows out of the gifts of autism, which she's written several books. One of us is called Animals Make Us Human. One of them is called Animals in Translation. Because of her autism, she thinks in pictures, not words, and she can see things from an animal's point of view. And what she does in her life is tries to make better lives for the animals that we are keeping for food, trying to make more comfortable surroundings for them, trying to make their deaths peaceful, and trying to keep track of the people who handle them to make sure they're handled in a humane way. And that's what this book that I'm working on now is
about. Nice. Really nice.
We'll look forward to that.
Yes.
And we want to thank you, Cy Montgomery, for being with us this evening. The book is Birdology, Lessons Learned from a Pack of Hens, a Peck of Pigeons, Cantankerous Crows, Fierce Falcons, Hip-Hop Parrots, Baby Hummingbirds, and One Murderously Big Cassowary. It's published by Simon Schuster. You can also learn more about Cy and the book on the authors section of the Simon & Schuster website. Again, thank you very much for being with us tonight, Cy.
Oh, it was a blast. Thank you for having me on. It was great.
Thanks for the great stories.
Thank you.
Bye.
Good night.
Good night. Ecotopia on KZFR. That's Little White Dove, performed by Voices on the Verge from their Live in Philadelphia album. We've been talking about birds tonight, and we thought we would include a couple of bird poems. These come from a website prepared by Tom Gannon, where he has anthologized a number of bird poems. Here are two that we thought are particularly interesting. The first one is a prose poem. It's by Joy Harjo. It's called My House is the Red Earth, and she's describing the country around her home in the area of Shiprock, Navajo Nation. She writes, "My house is the red earth. It could be the center of the world. I've heard New York, Paris, or Tokyo called the center of the world, but I say it is magnificently humble. You could drive by and miss it. Radio waves can obscure it. Words cannot construct it, for there are some sounds left to sacred wordless form. For instance, that fool crow picking through trash near the corral understands the center of the world as greasy scraps of fat. Just ask him. He doesn't have to say that the earth has turned scarlet through fierce belief after centuries of heartbreak and laughter. He perches on the blue bowl of the sky and laughs. If you look with the mind of the swirling earth near Shiprock, you become the land. Beautiful. and understand how three crows at the edge of the highway laughing become three crows at the edge of the world laughing.
And this poem is by Linda Hogan from her book of poetry, Book of Medicines. It's called Crow Law. The temple where crow worships walks forward in tall black grass. Betrayal is crow's way of saying grace to the wolf so it can eat what is left when blood is on the ground, until what remains of moose is crow walking out the sacred temple of ribs in a dance of leaving the red tracks of scarce and private gods. It is the oldest war where moose becomes wolf and crow, where the road ceases to become the old forest, where crow is calling, where we are still afraid.
And that again, two poems by Linda Hogan, and before that by Joy Harjo. Tonight on Ecotopia, we've talked about birding. There's a number of activity sites on the web that might be of interest to listeners and their families. For example, the website 4-2-Explore has activities that are directed to kids but could become whole family activities. They suggest, for example, starting a birding journal, and they have websites that you can surf to select topics for your birding journal. You decide what you're going to include in the journal, and then you identify various species and create your birding journal.
There are also numerous sites for people of all ages who want to learn more about birds and participate in bird conservation. Right here in the North State, for example, the Alta Cal chapter of the Audubon Society includes monthly meetings at the Chico Creek Nature Center and frequent bird walks and trips. Coming up in the next couple of months are trips to the Mono Lake region, Point Reyes Seashore, and closer to home, the Oroville Wildlife Area. The Alta Cal chapter is also a major sponsor of the annual Snow Goose Festival, and you can find more information at www.altacal.org.
And while you're online, check out the website of the National Audubon Society, which includes a number of activist links on topics: the Gulf oil spill, global warming, energy problems, endangered species, ecosystem restoration, wind power, clean water, and agriculture. They're online at www.audubon.org.
And that does it for Ecotopia for tonight, as we have been exploring birdology. Thank you for listening.
Next week, we'll be continuing our coverage of the voyage of the Plastiki. That's the catamaran constructed of recycled soft drink and other bottles that has been sailing from San Francisco to Sydney to promote understanding of ocean pollution issues. You may have seen them on national TV last night. They have just arrived in Sydney Harbor.
The Plastiki has landed, and we'll be talking with Skipper Jo Royal. And we've talked with her twice as this has been in process. And we'll learn more about her adventures during the long trek and her observations of ocean health.
This program is made possible in part by member contributions and by Cartridge World in Chico, specializing in printer cartridge refilling and remanufacturing for a green community. Cartridge World uses recycled cartridges for most home and business printers, copiers, and faxes. Cartridge World in Chico is located inside the Safeway Plaza next to Tri-County's Bank. More information is available by calling 342-3333.
Coming up at 7 this evening is the storyteller with your anthropological guide, Adrian Scott, bringing you stories, legends, and music from long ago and modern-day cultures. Join Adrian for a trip around the world exploring the hopes, fears, and dreams that are universal to all people. And at 7:30, It's All Mixed Up, bringing you 2.5 hours of rock and pop from the edges of mainstream and contemporary music, blurring the boundaries of most commercial radio. Stay tuned and enjoy listening to a world that is all mixed up.
Thank you for listening to Ecotopia. I'm Susan Chudy.
We want to thank Jeff Inslee for being with us again tonight. I'm Stephen Chudy. Contact us at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com or visit our website, ecotopiakzfr.net. And you can also become our friends on Facebook and receive advance notice of upcoming shows. Thanks for listening.
gave me the hope.